Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Ralph White is a cultural change agent of the highest order. He is co-founder and creative director of the New York Open Center, America's leading urban institution of holistic learning, now for over 30 years. Maybe it's even more like 35.
Yeah, it is.
And in addition to serving as creative director, Ralph is an authority on spirituality, consciousness, the history of the Western mystical tradition. He's the author of a fantastic book, a philosophical memoir entitled The Jeweled Highway, On the Quest for a Life of Meaning. One of his previous writings, A Walk on the Wild Side of Tibet, was published in Tibet, True Stories. He's also written commentary on the political goals of the religious far right for the Huffington Post and contributed articles on Alternative Community, the National Network, actually International Network of Holistic Centers, which Ralph basically founded, and the philosopher Rudolf Steiner. Ralph has made many appearances in the media. We're so delighted to have him on Pathways today. He was born and grew up in Wales in the north of England. He came to the United States in 1970 as a Fulbright scholar. He was program director of the Omega Institute in the early 80s, having organized many major national and international conferences on a broad range of spiritual and alternative themes. Ralph is considered to be one of the most knowledgeable holistic learning professionals in America. His series of international conferences known as Esoteric Quests are the leading events in the world that are focused on the Western mystical tradition. And as a graduate of one of those quests, I can attest to that. Established in 1995 by Ralph, the Esoteric Quests are now entering their 24th year. Well, hello, Ralph, and welcome to Pathways.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I enjoy Oregon, and here I am.
Well, and you know, I know what brings you here, because you were just up at the Centers Gathering, which is that movement I just mentioned in the intro, that you helped found.
Yes.
And they had their annual conference, which is sort of like, I've been to a number of them, because I contribute to that movement. I have to... You know, that's full disclosure. But it's an incredible it's an incredible movement, and they have their trade show like thing where they all the different centers in the world, the big ones, or many of them, meet at this conference every year and share notes and help each other, and it's like a movement. Would you call it a movement, Ralph? Have you started a movement?
One of the ways I define the annual holistic Centers Gathering, which has now become the Holistic Centers Network, is that I say it's the consciousness movement becoming conscious of itself. Because you have many isolated centers, places where people have come together to explore whatever it is, the whole body-mind thing, the mystical thing, the all the different dimensions of a more holistic, ecological, and spiritual worldview. So there's an inherent power and value in these centers becoming aware of each other, supporting each other, meeting in an open-hearted, candid spirit of aware that we're part of a greater whole, that we're all in some way contributing to whatever phrase you care to use. You could call it the evolution of consciousness. You could call it a necessary response to the multiple dire crises our short-sighted materialistic thinking has brought us to right now, in terms of climate change, species extinction, how much more feedback do we need from the universe that we're on the wrong track? And these centers are places that can explore, well, what it is, how do we become more human? If we're not focused on short-term economic growth and profit and Wall Street and all of that that drives the global economy, but what are we focused on? And you could say we're focused on being more present, finding joy in life more, appreciating the beauty of nature, finding a way to listen to and respond to the intelligence of nature, and of course, you know, becoming more noble beings if we can, you know, spiritually, psychologically, etc.
This is like the original vision of the so-called hippie movement of the 1960s. You know, this concept that we can live in a way that's in alignment and harmony with nature. The role of some plant medicines in terms of awakening consciousness.
Yes, all of that. I agree. I mean, I just did one of the esoteric quests in Peru and Bolivia. And if you see some of the statuary there that is thousands of years old, you can see figures with the San Pedro cactus in their arm during some kind of profound ritual that we don't fully understand. So yeah, the Western Hemisphere has been characterized by an understanding of plant medicines, and this is the time with Michael Pollan and so on that this is coming back into consciousness. I co-founded a place called the New York Open Center, which has been New York City's main center of holistic learning for the last 35 or so years. And of course, that's why I've been involved with the center's network, because this is, you know, a major urban center.
So, you know, somebody who's like a Republican capitalist would look at the center's gathering and say, what's the benefit of sharing, you know, with each other? Aren't you really competitors?
That's the prevailing paradigm, isn't it? That we should all be seeking to do each other down and get one up on each other. But, you know, it's that one-sided view of evolution. It's the view of evolution that identifies us with the chimpanzees instead of the bonobos. It's the fact is we're equally genetically close to both of them. And cooperation is every bit as significant, if not more, than competition. And in fact, evolution depends on how we really interact with and cooperate with other species and other, you know, realms.
That's our biggest advantage as a species.
Yeah.
So for the listeners who don't know about the bonobos, you know, explain the difference. It's a type of chimpanzee.
Yeah, they're the closest to us that you could have. They're equally close with the chimpanzees. You know,
we're talking 99.5%.
I think that's right. Something like that. Some huge element. You know, it's most of who we are genetically, I think. And, you know, we grew up when I was young. I remember we heard about Robert Ardrey and the territorial imperative. And then when push came to shove, we were mean sons. You know, we were going to kick ass. We were going to murder. We were going to kill to protect our territory, our ownership, our hierarchy. And, okay, this was presented kind of social Darwinism. That ultimately it's this rough and tumble world and only the fittest survive and the fittest are the most ruthless.
Right.
The bonobos instead are, they're more matriarchal than patriarchal. Instead of engaging in when confrontation conflict arises, they're predisposed to solve the problem through having sex with the partner. The parents are complicit in this and supportive of it. The bonobos are certainly a very sex-positive culture or species or whatever you want to call them.
Sex-positive feminism.
Yeah, and it's a little hint for us.
I mean, including a hetero element.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a thing for us right now. I feel, I don't know about you, Paul, but I feel like we are entering into the age of the woman, the age of women. You know, it's women are stepping into their own power on so many levels, and it's great. And I think, you know, I can only speak for myself, but, you know, thoughts about, you know, if women get the power, we're going to be diminished. My view is the more power and influence women have, the more fun it's going to be for everybody, and that their wisdom and their sensuality and everything else is the archetypal feminine is deeply needed in our culture, and I'm down with it, you know.
Hey, if the bonobo social solution works so much better than dog-eat-dog, I'm all for it.
Well, exactly. The thing is, it's not just dog-eat-dog and the competitive machismo absurdity that we have lived through for so many years now. It's the fact that it's not just wrecking our souls, you know, it's totally trashing the biosphere. And, you know, we have to have, you know, that relationship to Gaia, to
Mother Nature.
Yeah, the Mother Nature, this world without which we're nothing. I mean, are you kidding me? What are we without? You know, we come out of, our bodies are formed from the earth. And without that, you know, we're just a trivial little blip in infinite
history.
Well,
isn't it amazing how the creation stories of religion can persist for 2,000 years?
Yeah.
I mean, what? How does that happen?
Well, I think that's a good question because, you know, look how long did the whole Marxist myth last of the dictatorship of the proletariat and class warfare and, you know, the blaming of the bourgeoisie and the eventual withering away of the state and, you know, the enlightened communists. It didn't happen. It was based upon, you know, I'm not saying Marx wasn't extremely perceptive in many ways about the nature of capitalism, but it's ultimately a materialistic worldview. It emerges from 19th century materialism.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things we have to let go. And one of the ways, instruments we have to do it, it wasn't available to Marx and Engels, was a real understanding of the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere and elsewhere.
Right.
And they're, you know, anything that happens now in the entheogenic world, etc., the sacred substances that Michael Pollan writes about, all the science now, you know, use of psilocybin with stage 4 cancer patients, it all stands on the shoulders of the great indigenous traditions of the, especially of the Americas, but not exclusively so, because I was just in Tiahuanaco in Bolivia near the shores of the, and we did an esoteric quest in Peru and Bolivia last summer, and we have to have the deepest respect for the indigenous cultures.
But here again, you know, when you look at the imperialist, colonist, you know, usurpers, of, you know, basically rapists of the environment and subjugators of the people, they based their reasoning on religion. You know, they're superior because they have God or whatever, and so they're entitled.
It's so tragic when you think of all the forms of Christianity that could have come to the Americas. With the, I'm not saying it was all sweetness and light. Obviously, it wasn't. There was difficult and dark stuff here too. But to have the indigenous spirituality of the Americas then invaded by one of the most grotesque forms of Christianity
and desecrated.
Torquemada, the Spanish arrive, Columbus. They're from the Catholic monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella. They've just defeated the last stronghold of the Moors, the last hangout of Al-Andalus, Andalusia. Granada has just fallen in 1492, the very year that Columbus arrives here, and they're into fanatical Catholicism. And, you know, the abuse of the indigenous peoples remains a huge crime.
And the indigenous people, according to a book I read entitled 1491, the indigenous people were massacred by disease before there was any fighting at all.
No
they
question
would have
about
kicked
it.
Ass.
Yes, of course. Well, they didn't have the technology, but they were massacred.
No, they had the technology. Bows and arrows were a lot better than those muskets.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's like they had it all, except that they were 90% of them were wiped out.
It was the flu. It was syphilis was available then. It was all the corrupt diseases that were symbolic of the corrupt psyche that Europeans brought. And yet, you know, and if you look at the evolution of consciousness, you have to ask yourself, couldn't the universe have arranged it in some better way so that when the Europeans got here, they didn't bring the horrible diseases and a grotesque religion that was a real come down from the indigenous spirituality that was already here. But that's what happened. You know, it's one of the mysteries of the cosmos that we live with. How and why did that happen?
Well, at least the indigenous spiritualities are having a little bit of a comeback.
They're coming back. And yeah, I tell you what, Paul, I mean, actually, you know, there's a lot of DNA going on. I'm a sucker for that. I did my DNA, both with National Geographic and Ancestry, because I'm in my own family, there's a bit of a mystery. And I'm so chuffed, as the British would say, to discover that I'm somewhere between 11 and 16% Native American. I'm so thrilled because, you know, I'm born in Wales, my father's born in Wales, my mother's born in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and I'm 16%, the highest estimate, Native American. And I love it. I've always loved the Native Americans. I had my spiritual awakening down Route 66 in New Mexico. in Arizona, as I write about in my book.
Yeah, your book, The Bejeweled Highway.
The Jeweled Highway.
The Jeweled Highway.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is a great book. So that's the story. And I want to let the listeners know about that. This book is a memoir and then some. How would you describe your book?
Well, the subtitle of it is On the Quest for a Life of Meaning. So the first third of the book is about my own personal quest because, you know, my grandfather was in the thick of the First World War, was mustard gassed and temporarily blinded at the Battle of the Somme. My father landed in Normandy and went through the whole Second World War and saw a lot of death. I've always been aware of the Holocaust and Stalin's atrocities. And, you know, and I grew up in that existential... I'd walked away from conventional religion by the time I was 13, 14. But, you know, and I was a sort of an angry, pissed off teenage existentialist who didn't see a lot of meaning in life. And was saved, as you might say, by rock and roll, because thankfully I was in the north of England at that point. We'd left Wales. And when the Beatles and the Animals and the Stones and the whole thing burst onto the scene in my total hormonal early adolescence, it was like, thank God. I mean, the only solace we had was lukewarm beer. And then suddenly, I mean, we didn't have any other substances. There was nothing of Native America and entheogens and ancient. It was a get it down your neck, lad. Saturday night, you know, pubs are closing at 10:30 and, you know, get a pint down your neck while you can. That's a little, for those who like Downton Abbey, that's how Mrs. Patmore speaks. Yeah.
So your book is the story of a quest for a life of meaning.
Yeah.
So do you think that you... is there any end to this quest? Or
I think it's the quest kind of goes on forever, you know, just like the esoteric quest, it never stops. And that's why I entitled it On the Quest, not, you know, the conclusion of the quest.
Right.
It's a process. It, you know, in terms of the esoteric conferences I do, we're going to be doing one in the end of August. It's going to be called An Esoteric Quest in Bulgaria at the Crossroads of the Mysteries. And it's going to be in ancient Bulgaria, the oldest living city in Europe, Plovdiv. We're going to go into the mysteries of Thrace, of Orpheus, the semi-divinity of song and poetry, who descends into the underworld. We're going to go down into Orpheus's cave, into the underground river, to just in search of Eurydice, the lost wife.
Wow. This is ancient Greek mythology.
Thracian, actually.
Thracian.
Orpheus is from Thrace, which precedes ancient Greece.
Wow.
To the north and what is now Bulgaria. So yeah, a layer upon layer of civilization there, the Thracians, the Greeks, the figurines, the 35,000-year-old archetypal feminine figurines with the breasts and the hips. You can find 35,000-year-old, the classic figures of the Great Mother.
This is when God was a woman.
Yeah, this dates from the Gimbutas's period, the Great Mother, before the patriarchy, before the sky gods. I mean, you can see them there. But also, there's a huge history here because some of our listeners may have heard of the Cathars in the south of France.
Right.
Who were contemporaries of the troubadours, and then they were the Bogomils in Sarajevo with the terrible war there and the siege. You know, that was a center for a totally esoteric, Gnostic spirituality.
Where are you going this year?
Bulgaria, near there. So that's what we're going nearby. So we go from south of France to Sarajevo, to where we're going to go this year, Plovdiv, Bulgaria.
Did you go to Sarajevo?
I did. I went there because I wanted to follow up on what's called the, you know, we call it the Manichaean tradition, but it's actually, they didn't call themselves that.
Right.
Mani was a third century prophet from Mesopotamia who understood that born into a Christian family, that Christianity, Zoroastrianism, and Buddhism all spoke the same essential truth. He traveled into Persia, then into Pakistan, Africa. Anyway, he understood all of that. And that came up to the Silk Road and went both east and west and created an esoteric world religion in the 12th and 13th century. So that's the kind of stuff I like to do. But
I know you did an esoteric quest in the Cathar region of France.
We did, yeah, yeah.
I wanted to go to that one. I went to one of them. I thought it was brilliant the way that you put these things together such that you have like bona fide experts on the period and on the stories.
Yes, that was true.
So educational, such a fun way.
Well, you know, I think there are four ingredients to alchemy. One is to go to these places, to actually be there in the south of France or Sicily or in Iceland, in, you know, going into the Norse mysteries. And then it's the quality of the teaching, and then it's the arts, and then it's the conviviality, the sociability. That's what makes it work.
So what would you say to young people who are wondering, you know, Ralph's life, and maybe they read your book and you wonder even harder.
I hope they will.
Ralph's life was so fascinating and had so many adventures of a unique kind. How can I have a life like that? What advice would you give to them? Would you tell them, how should they find their way?
Well, first of all, I have to say, you know, we've got to get rid of people being burdened with this college debt.
Yeah.
When they're in their 20s, I mean, really, screw that. That's a disgrace. I was fortunate enough to graduate with no debt, and I was able to be free to, you know, hitchhike to Machu Picchu when I was 23. It might have been existentially incredibly stressful. But, you know, so I think we have to support, you know, the Bernies, Elizabeth Warrens, as my own personal point of view, because the rich must be taxed. They must pay their share, and it must go to give people freedom. So I'm saying this because in order to live the kind of life I have, you have to have freedom.
They say that the depression rates of people saddled with a lot of student loan debt are through the roof.
It's terrible. It's absolutely appalling.
It makes sense.
And it's, what is it serving? You know, 1% of the population.
So I think it's criminal. I think it's criminal to offer that kind of credit to somebody that young.
It's a betrayal of American democracy.
Oh, and
it's like, you know, 16 tons and what do you get? Another day old on deeper in debt. You know, I owe my soul to the company store. I mean, that's been allowed to happen. That's why the progressive forces on a socio-political level have to take it back. You know, I'm from New York, and my neighboring representative in Queens and is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And she, you know, she and I are very much on the same wavelength about the Green New Deal and all of that. So that's on the practical level, on the more spiritual, existential, individualistic level. Well, I don't know, you know. I was fortunate enough to, even though it was difficult and lonely and extremely stressful, to actually be able to follow what I felt I had to do to find meaning, because I didn't grow up with a spiritual view of the world. I'd walked out on the church by the time I was 13 or 14. It was only in my 20s going down Route 66 into the deserts of New Mexico and Arizona, being under those starless skies.
Hitchhiking?
No, it was a dry as an ad for a co-driver from Chicago. I was a TA, a teaching assistant in Chicago, and I answered an ad for a co-driver to LA down Route 66, and I always wanted to do it, and we set off, and whoa, I've never recovered from that month. And Linda, if you're listening, I know you're in Portland somewhere out there, but you know, I know we're going to get together, because I couldn't believe when my book came out, and there's an author, I got a box of it. At the very day that box of author's books arrived, I got a Facebook friend request from Linda, who I did that trip down Route 66 with, who I hadn't heard from in 20 years.
Synchronicity.
So life is deep. You're the maestro of synchronicity with your work and your oracular.
Hey, everything that happens as creative has got a synchronistic element or two.
Well, I mean, what did Jung say about a synchronicity? It's a mystery that it's up to us to decode. Well, it's not handed to us on a platter. We don't want a priest or a vicar or a pope.
Well, it gets back to that word meaning.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
What did Jung call the synchronicity? A meaningful coincidence.
Yes, a meaningful coincidence.
Who ferrets out the meaning?
It's us.
Exactly.
With a little help from the universe.
Or we don't. It's just a coincidence.
Listen, I'm going to go to my grave never having figured out why certain things happen.
Oh, definitely.
And on the other hand, you know, an incredible synchronicity that I experienced, which led to the healing of one of the two or so really broken relationships in my life. And without that synchronicity, we would never have healed. I mean, yeah, sometimes you follow up on it, you feel it, and you're grateful for it. And I can say from my experience of having been so blown away by the synchronicity that I felt I had no choice but to respond, it healed a significant trauma and wound that she and I had both carried for years. So, you know, if anything, that experience is a testimony to the value of responding.
Well, right. I mean, in my book, which is going to be renamed and coming out under the title intuitive intelligence.
Oh, I like that. It's a good title.
I talk, it's about great decisions and perfect timing. Yeah. It's the old title.
I like the new title.
I make the point that synchronicity is operative all the time.
Mm.
It's just that we don't notice it.
Mm.
We kind of, it's perfect timing. In other words, if you buy into the idea, and I call it a visionary belief because it's completely optional and up to you, if you can test out the belief that everything happens for a reason and that there is some kind of perfection to the way things unfold, even if there's a lot of pain sometimes, then you realize, oh yeah, synchronicity is just the norm. It's the norm, but we don't notice it except when it kind of hits us over the head.
Yeah, right. And but sometimes it does hit us over the head with such force that we can't ignore it. But yeah, and people have said my book, The Jeweled Highway, is it does, although I wasn't really aware as I was writing it, but it has a lot of synchronicities in it. And
yeah, we just have to learn to be aware of it and look for it.
Well,
and find the meaning in it.
I mean, the other word for it that we have in the West is destiny. Of course, we have more karma in now. But there's destiny in all of this. And how does destiny work? And is there a deeper meaning and a deeper pattern to life despite the horrors and the atrocities and the stupidities? And, you know, the view I take after this sojourn through the veil of tears is, yeah, there it does have meaning. There is a logos.
It all comes back to meaning, as in the subtitle of your book.
Mm.
And it's been really great having this conversation with you, Ralph.
Likewise, Paul.
Thank you for being here. It's great to see
pleasure.
You. Is there a website you want to mention?
Yes, you can go to my own website, which is ralphwhite, like the color, .net. You can also go to esotericquest.org.
Okay. I also want to call attention to the Holistic Centers Network website, www.centersnetwork.org. The International Holistic Centers movement that you started so long ago, which is growing faster than ever, connecting people to centers of spiritual experience. Centersnetwork.org.
Yeah.
Well, we've run out of time for today's show. For those who tuned in late, this is Paul O'Brien, and you can replay this entire interview anytime you want via the internet at divination.com or kboo.fm. Today we've been visiting with Ralph White, author of The Jeweled Highway, On the Quest for a Life of Meaning, founder of the Open Center in New York, one of the founders of the International Holistic Centers Gathering. To our listeners, I want to say thank you for tuning into Pathways, which is made possible with your support. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. That's divination.com. This is your host, Paul O'Brien, reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways and its podcast, the interview program dedicated to personal and cultural evolution. Thanks again for tuning in and being a part of the conversation.